This is Talking Dementia with Remo Health. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Silverman. Join us as we explore the latest advancements, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we speak with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, I'm here with Dr. Adeline Goss. Adeline is a neurologist and writer. She is a practicing neurohospitalist at Highland Hospital, a public teaching hospital in Oakland, California. She completed her neurology residency and neurohospitalist fellowship at UCSF, medical internship at Massachusetts General Hospital, and medical school at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. She is the host and executive producer of the American Neurological Association's podcast, ANA Investigates. She is also the author of a beautiful essay in the Boston Globe, which is called, What Should We Think of the New Alzheimer's Drugs? Thank you so much for being here, Adeline.
Great to be with you, Emily.
So tell us a bit about your role as a neurohospitalist.
Neurohospitalist is a subspecialty of neurology that's focused on inpatient neurology, so neurology in the hospital, greeting patients in the emergency department, on the floors of the hospital and in the ICU, and managing those acute, urgent types of neurologic problems, stroke being a major one, seizures, meningitis, multiple sclerosis flares, delirium, other things that can come up in the hospital. I have a small clinic and see people after they've left the hospital as a discharge follow-up, but otherwise, most of what I do is in the hospital setting.
You've been working in neurology for a long time now. Tell us a bit about your experience with dementia patients before your mom got sick and how you thought about dementia then and the extent to which you interfaced with dementia patients before that.
Alzheimer's dementia is such a slow process for most patients that I became a neurologist alongside the process of my mother developing dementia. I think the two really unfolded along the same timeline. For example, when my mom was first having the earliest signs that she was having trouble with her memory, I was in medical school. I was living in the same city as her, but I really didn't have enough medical knowledge to feel any confidence about whether what I was seeing was the early signs of a disease or something else, like her being stressed or tired or having mood trouble. I think, like many people, I was new to all of this and I felt concerned that she was repeating herself, but I thought that there were many other possible explanations. And as I moved through my training, finished medical school, entered internship, and then residency, similarly, she was gaining more clarity on her diagnosis. And I was gaining more clarity on what dementia is, what Alzheimer's is, and linking some of her earliest symptoms to what can be the earliest symptoms of this disease. So to more directly answer your question, I think that my perception of Alzheimer's in training was a little bit more cookie cutter, like this is what somebody looks like when they have really obvious advanced dementia or moderate dementia, or they're just clearly having memory trouble. And even after a 5-minute interview, I would have signs of that. But I think what was hard at the beginning was that those signs are not as clear. And you're just working with a person who you love very much. And there's a slight deviation in how that person is behaving that doesn't necessarily scream dementia.
That's something that I've heard in conversations I've had with people taking care of loved ones with dementia, which is when you ask, when did this start? The first story they tell is from maybe a year ago. And then it's like, did it start before that? And it's like, well, actually, 2 years ago, there was this other thing. Or actually, 5 years ago, there was this other thing. And the way in which the retrospect feels clearer, but then when you're in it, it feels like, oh, well, maybe she's having a bad day or she's just tired. Or I wonder if you could comment a little bit more about that. Like just early stages, it's not a picture that we see a lot in the media. It's not something that I think people think of when they think Alzheimer's, those early stages. So if you have any reflections on those early years.
I couldn't agree more with that clinical observation. I feel like I'm saying that to trainees all the time, to my medical students and residents that I teach, that simply asking what was the first sign that your parent had a memory problem is just inadequate. And instead, we almost have to break down what it is to be a thinking human being into a bunch of different pieces and ask much more granular questions. When was the last time your mom was managing all of her finances by herself? When was the last time your mom was driving comfortably in the city? When was the last time that your mom was operating totally independently at work and having no difficulty? Then we find that we're reaching farther and farther and farther back, and sometimes pulling up these really early preclinical signs that nobody would say, oh, well, that's definitely a sign of Alzheimer's, but where you start to see this disease take shape. For me, the really obvious thing was that my mom was repeating herself, repeating simple things over the course of a given day, or repeating the same questions over the course of a day, often hours apart. But when I reached back farther, I was also noticing that this person who had really been my number one person in my life, she was a single mom for much of my childhood. I'm an only child. We were so bonded. There were just these signs that she was a little bit farther away, a little bit less accessible, a little bit less available, and a little bit less aware of like all of the in and out complexities of my life, which, you know, it's easy to chalk that up to me being an adult. It's not necessary for a parent to be like 100% engaged with every granular detail of my life, but it was different for her because this may sound sort of self-centered, but I know that I was the most important thing in my mom's life for all of my life. And that remained true, but the way that she expressed it was subtly, subtly different. I knew something was off even then, but as we do, I could think of a million other potential explanations, and it wasn't until a few years later when the questioning began that I really started to be concerned that something else was going on.
I could imagine scenarios where people are noticing changes in a loved one, and actually it isn't dementia. It is that maybe there's a different medical issue going on, or it is normal aging, or it is a psychiatric issue, or, you know, it's something else. So for people listening who are in that phase of things where it's like, I'm a little worried, I'm not sure if I should be worried, do you have any advice for them of like, if to worry, when to worry, whether they need to take action or do something, or whether the best action is actually just to monitor and continue to watch and just have an eye on it? What advice would you have for people in that stage where the future is still not clear?
It's such an important question, and I'm noticing how you use the word worry, because I think that is a big part of it, the powerless, ever-present itch, like something is wrong, something is wrong. I think the most important thing that a person can do at that point is to seek care from somebody who's taking a lot of these details into account. So I'm biased, but my advice would be to get to a neurologist, and ideally a behavioral neurologist, somebody who specializes in dementia, and somebody who can do enough neuropsychological testing. These are the detailed memory and cognitive tests that we're really taking into account. Who was this person before these symptoms started? And what would we expect that person to be able to do on these tests? So I think we've all become familiar with the existence of basic memory testing, like a single page document with pictures of a camel or something on it that does test memory. It tests different aspects of the brain's cognitive function. If you administer that to a lot of people with these early memory changes, they can get a perfect score. And for my mom, who is, I should say, herself a physician, who completed not just a medical degree, but also a business degree. She did very, very well on her basic cognitive testing. And yet, the more advanced cognitive testing did pick up some issues that were suggestive that the main problem was short-term memory, like we see in Alzheimer's. And simultaneously, she saw providers who were really seriously considering the effect of stress on her cognitive performance, the effect of mood on her cognitive performance, the effect of loss of sleep on her cognitive performance. Even with all of that and some basic lab testing and other things that doctors would check under this circumstance, there was ambiguity in the diagnosis.
Something we've been trying to help people understand is this idea that dementia comes in stages. So as we talked about earlier, when you hear the word Alzheimer's, a lot of people think about late stage Alzheimer's, but there's earlier stages and there's even a pre-stage of sorts, which we refer to as mild cognitive impairment or MCI. And there was a line in your beautiful essay in the Boston Globe, which you wrote about you and your mom and getting treatment for Alzheimer's. There was a line in the essay that said, "I've noticed this particularly since we've moved from mild cognitive impairment to mild dementia. With fewer new memories forming, my mother seems to be floating in the present as though in a meditation." So I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that transition from mild cognitive impairment or MCI to dementia and what that was like for you and your family, and also how you think about that as a neurologist.
I find this distinction very challenging on both levels, both as a neurologist and as a family member to someone with dementia, because I think there's a lot of subjectivity in the transition from MCI to dementia, and also because what it means to make that transition, again, really differs based on what a person was doing and capable of before they develop this disease. So technically speaking, to wind up with a diagnosis of MCI, a person has to have clinical signs, evidence of there being some problem with their cognition, often in memory, but sometimes other aspects like trouble with learning or language or decision making, social changes, etc. And those changes can't be explained away by some other problem, like we discussed before, some other problem like depression or hyperthyroidism or something like that, you know, some medical diagnosis or a medication that the person may be taking, something that can be removed. So that gets us to a diagnosis of MCI. The person transitioning to a diagnosis of mild dementia, when those changes are affecting their function in their daily life in a significant way. And, you know, this is audio only, so you can't see my air quotes, but that's really hard. What constitutes a significant change in function is so subjective. So let me give you an example from my mom. My mom was a professional woman. She worked a million hours in her life. She was extremely intellectually active, and she was very involved in caring for me. My mom would tell you that she has never cooked. She has really never done any substantive cleaning of our home. She relies on systems and always has to keep her organized. For example, extensive note-taking, printing out tons of documents to have them stacked and at the ready on her office desk, heavy use of smartphone maps apps to help her get around, auto pay for her bills. Everything that could be automated in her life, she automated, and everything that she could support someone else to do for her, she wanted to do. And so when you start to flip through the basic stuff that people tend to do for themselves, my mom already lost a bunch of points by the way that she lived her life before she had any signs of this disease. And so keeping track of changes was really hard. Even now that her disease has progressed, it's really hard to notice those subtle changes. So again, to your question and to the quote that you offered from the piece that I wrote, what I notice is less quantifiable, less binary. Oh yeah, she used to drive and now she doesn't drive. I mean, that's true, but I think the more qualitative shifts are more impressive to me and more meaningful to me. And I think other people who have lived through this as a caregiver or as a family member to somebody with dementia have told me the same. I think, for example, there was a time when my mom was a major collaborator in decision-making in my life. If I had to make a choice about how to manage my career or way back when my education, she was there with a yellow ruled notepad, sketching it all out, writing down all the names, lines, and arrows, and would come up with a list of next steps. And then she would help me figure out how to do the next steps. And then I would do the next steps. And then she'd check in the next day and see what progress I'd made and come up with the next steps together. And that kind of really comforting, powerful support and the ability to manipulate huge amounts of information on someone else's behalf, that's something my mom still really wants to do and still really tries to do. But it's no longer possible for her to keep up that thread, to keep track of all of these tendrils of information and support me. My mom is there emotionally. She wants to listen. She cares deeply, but the bits and pieces are not available to her as they were before.
What about this piece of the quote where it said she was floating in the present as though in a meditation? How does that tie in to what you just said about losing the thread or not being able to hold all of the tendrils of information?
I wrote that really in a way to celebrate something that is coming with Alzheimer's for my mom that I think is really beautiful. And it's that as these bits and pieces of life fall away from her attention or her ability to hold on to them, a purer, more visceral and immediate reality seems to be where she is. So she's not thinking of the future unless there's something in particular she's worried or fixated about, which can happen with Alzheimer's. But generally, she's not really thinking about the future. She can't remember much of the recent past. So she's just here. And that can be really nice. If here is a happy place, which thankfully it usually is for her, for us, she is just in it. And in a room of other people, the only people currently who are like fully in the moment, if my mom is around with me and my family, is like my mom and my 20-month-old. And it's beautiful. She's just really enjoying now in a way that I don't have access to. And so I've had the good fortune to learn from dementia experts in my medical training. And I remember Dr. Bruce Miller of UCSF, who is an incredible doctor and was an incredible mentor for me, really speaking to the positive things that can come with a dementia diagnosis. And for me, this is one of the most positive things that has come for my mom, a shedding of all that she used to manage and a deep, pure enjoyment of the present moment. I wish all of us had access to that.
That reminds me of another quote from your piece where you wrote, "At home, she'll get down on the rug with my son. He'll want to throw her the ball over and over, laugh, throw the ball, laugh, throw the ball. And she'll be right there, laughing and throwing, until 10 minutes have passed, 20, 30, never once glancing at the clock. She can stretch out his laughter into an eternity of joy." And I loved that so much. The whole mindfulness movement that we see today, I think, is in part there because so many of us have trouble being in the moment, being in the now, whether our minds are stuck in the future, goal-oriented, future-oriented, next steps, or whether our minds are anchored in the past, thinking about old mistakes and old things that happened and not being able to move on. And so I wonder if you can say a bit more about this presence and what in some cases may even be a silver lining of living with this diagnosis is that does it just condense time into the present in a way that can be really liberating?
Yeah, it is so beautiful to watch that. It's kind of crushingly beautiful because in that scene that you read from this essay, there's this temporariness in everything that I'm observing. And that temporariness, if I dwell on it, is enough for me to be moved to tears. But I think in this way, I'm very lucky to have young children as a channel through which I experience this current version of my mom. If I sit alone with my mom for a long stretch and I'm not in the right space, it can be hard for me to really just relax and enjoy her. As you're describing, I need an injection of mindfulness myself, and I can get antsy. I can feel like we're not going anywhere. I really have appreciated how my children help me identify activities that I enjoy that don't require a lot of cognitive precision and that may be a little bit repetitive or a little bit flowy. And those are exactly the activities that are most enjoyable with my mom. Taking a beautiful walk, watching the solar eclipse, anything involving my young children. These are things that are really good for me. They're really good for her, and that are pretty inclusive of anybody who wants to participate. So my kids have unlocked that for me, and simultaneously my mom has unlocked that for me.
I want to talk about the drug that you bring up in the piece. The drug is called lecanemab. What is lecanemab and how does it work?
So lecanemab, also called Leqembi, if people are more familiar with the brand name. Lecanemab is a monoclonal antibody, which means that it's an antibody that targets a specific thing. It targets amyloid protein in the brain. Amyloid beta protein is one of the proteins that has been found to deposit in the brain in association with Alzheimer's disease. And this drug is quite effective at removing amyloid beta protein from the brain. In this way, this drug is different from some of the other drugs that are routinely used in Alzheimer's disease. Those other drugs, it's harder to make a case that the drug is actually directly affecting the pathology, the stuff that happens to make Alzheimer's Alzheimer's. The other differences are not really about how the drug works, but really about how it's administered and what that means for patients. So lecanemab is now one of two monoclonal antibodies that are FDA approved and available to patients. The other one is donanemab. Lecanemab was the first of those two. And both of these drugs are given through an intravenous infusion, not a pill, but rather a patient goes to a special infusion center associated with a hospital and gets an IV put in their arm and receives the medication over a period of time and then has a period of being observed to make sure that the medication went in safely and then has the IV removed and goes home. And as a result, there's drive time, there's sit time, there's wait time. And because a lot of people with MCI and certainly dementia are not driving anymore, that has a real impact on patients' caregivers. For lecanemab, these infusions happen every 2 weeks. And for donanemab, it's once every 4 weeks, once a month. So then there's these other differences, and probably most important to mention is that both of these monoclonal antibodies are extremely, extremely expensive. But lecanemab is marketed at $26,000 or so per year. And then in order to even receive the drug, a person has to have serial images of their brain through MRI, some confirmation that the disease they have is actually Alzheimer's, which either requires spinal fluid testing or a special test called an amyloid PET scan to confirm that there's amyloid beta in the brain. Many people wind up with genetic testing because people with a specific genetic mutation called APOE4, if they have two copies of that gene, they shouldn't receive these medications. They're too dangerous for those patients. So there's all of this plus the neurological visits and everything a person with dementia would routinely get, and that adds to the cost of these drugs. Now, a patient doesn't see all of that because Medicare and or their additional insurers would cover a lot of it, but it doesn't cover all of it. And as a result, many, many patients cannot afford these medications. The other big difference is that there are significant risks to these medicines. So they're doing a pretty serious thing. They're removing a protein from the brain. And sometimes in that process, there's inflammation that occurs in the brain. That inflammation in the brain, as the proteins are getting removed, can also lead to bleeding or hemorrhage in the brain. And that process has its own special name called ARIA. And that swelling, inflammation, bleeding occurs in about 20% to a quarter of patients who receive lecanemab. For some patients, that can be a very serious complication. For others, it's not that serious, but it does lead to stopping the drug. So those are much more significant risks also than the Alzheimer's medications that most people would be familiar with. As a result, the process of approving these medications was a big deal. There's quite a bit of debate surrounding their use. There's quite a bit of concern about cost, and the real life effect of taking these medications on a patient and on their caregivers feels really different than taking some of the other medications that have been routinely prescribed for years or decades.
So when a person is considering taking this medicine or thinking through that decision with their loved ones, there's the risks, there's the benefits, there's the cost, there's a lot of different moving pieces. You mentioned the risk of bleeding in the brain, swelling in the brain. You also mentioned the way that it works, removing this protein. I'm wondering if you could speak a bit more to the benefits of the drug. Like, as you're removing the protein, does that mean you live longer? Does that mean you get memory back? Does that mean you lose your memory less quickly? What are the benefits? And then how did you navigate that risk-benefit conversation with your mom?
This is so important to understand about these medications and about all current medications for Alzheimer's. There's no medication that has been shown in Alzheimer's to reverse the disease and make someone better. So these medications, all they do, which may be very meaningful for some people, but to be clear, all they do is they slow down the disease on average. And for a specific patient, you can't know if it's working or not, because you can't compare the patient if they do take the medication to the patient if they don't take the medication, because they're just one person and they're either taking it or they're not taking it. So you assume all this risk, and there isn't a very satisfying result where your day-to-day life feels and looks better. So this gets to my mom, and I think she's a really good example of someone for whom this drug still makes sense. She is a physician, and specifically, she ran clinical trials in hepatitis C and was really one of many important pioneers in developing treatments for hepatitis C, and eventually treatments for hepatitis C that could cure the virus in many people. So my mom spent her entire career in medical science, and really in optimistic medical science. She started in a disease that was really quite dark, where a lot of her patients were dying of hepatitis, and wound up ending her career by leading the transition to market of a drug that could cure the disease in many people who received it. So hers is a path of optimism, and using her own optimism and clinical prowess and scientific prowess to instill optimism in her patients. So for my mom, who trusts studies and population level data, and for my mom, who is very comfortable with the ins and outs of new therapies and was very curious about novel compounds for Alzheimer's, she was thrilled that lecanemab showed positive results in the trials, and she was very eager to get on it. And the way we've talked about this over time is that if I remind her of the risks of the medication and the difficulty tracking its effect, she will usually respond by saying, yeah, is there anything better? And there's nothing particularly better than lecanemab and donanemab. So she's like, all right, let's do it. And if I get worse or if I have a complication, we'll revisit it. And I should add, she can afford the medication. So that also makes this possible for her. There's more nuance there. I think that the process of consenting to a complicated treatment like this when a person has cognitive impairment is harder. It's different. We can only, for example, present pieces of the story to my mom and get her to weigh in on those pieces as we're navigating this and other medical decisions. But she can very consistently weigh in on those pieces. And so for the moment, I still feel confident that my mom is leading the decision to continue taking this treatment. And if, when in the future, she cannot hold those pieces anymore or reliably comment on the decision before her, then I think our role will be stronger and she'll take more of a backseat. But I think as a physician, I think about that a lot. I am a neurologist. A lot of my patients need support to make medical decisions. And I really, really wrestled with whether my mom was making this one or whether I was and my stepfather was. And I think the reality is that right now it's a combination of all of us. My stepfather and I have to frame the information in a certain way, but my mom and her spirit and her values and her optimism are leading us just in a very different way than they would have before.
I love what you said about your mom thinking about the medication and saying, well, is there anything better? Because if there's not anything better, I want to try this. And there was a line in your piece where you say, this is a drug that can cost tens of thousands of dollars out of pocket, that carries a 22% risk of brain hemorrhage or swelling, that requires biweekly infusions for a year and a half to potentially delay the progression from mild to more advanced Alzheimer's by only a few months. So is the benefit really that small? I know that we don't have anything to make people better, but the slowing down of the disease progression, help the audience understand how helpful is this medication on a population level?
Yep, that's it. it slows it down by a few months over a span of 18 months. People will take a couple more months to progress to the next stages of Alzheimer's. That's it. Every time I talk about this drug to somebody who is not facing this type of decision, they're like, wait, really? a lot of people have heard about this drug and they're curious. On first glance, it's like, wow, flashy new drug. That's it. And I think to a scientist or to a physician, that's not all that surprising. I was not expecting a miracle cure for Alzheimer's. I don't expect it anytime soon, but I do hope and expect that we make incremental progress. This is incremental progress.
You mentioned being a neurologist and making difficult decisions with people who have cognitive impairment or difficulty thinking, and how you can present pieces of the story to your mom and she can reliably respond to that. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, sometimes when we think about decision making, we think about who is the decision maker. There's either the patient or the patient's not able to do that, and then it's someone else, maybe someone in the family, and there is a decision maker. And then we also have this idea in medicine of shared decision making, where it's a collaboration, it's a conversation, it's a discussion. And at the end of the day, someone has to be the one actually giving the green light and making the decision. So I'm wondering how you think about that, like the binary, who's making the decision, you or me, or this more shared decision making process and incorporating different perspectives into the decision. And it just can feel so messy at times, but that's life. It's progressive. So you might be able to weigh in and not have full insight, but have some insight. And so I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
I love the way you presented that, that in medical training in particular, I remember just being like, well, who's on the forms? Who do I call in case of an emergency? And who's going to decide if this patient's going to be intubated? But yeah, totally. It is usually messier. Provided that a patient is awake and speaking, communicating in some way, they're there. They have a stake, and to some degree, they may or may not be able to present their perspective on the decision that lies before them. And the role of then the person who's with them or supporting them is hard to quantify. And that's a little uncomfortable. I mean, I have an interest in in palliative care and a number of mentors who I've thought with a lot in neuropalliative care, as in how do we manage serious neurologic illness and the symptoms of serious neurologic illness and decision-making in that setting. So this is something I've thought about academically. It is hard to know what to do with the caregiver who's supporting decision-making and how to deal with that person's feelings and preferences, their recall of what a patient would have wanted, their representation of what a patient would have wanted. This is inherently tricky. In dementia, I guess to simplify this a little bit, it's a physician who's helping make decisions with a patient with dementia needs to figure out how to present that information at a level that a patient with dementia can manipulate it and speak their thoughts. And they have to try lots of different ways. That's my commitment anyway. I really think that being formulaic about it, trying to ask a question one way, getting a not very satisfying answer and moving on and asking another family member, that's not going to work. I've really learned from my mom that you just have to try in different ways and experiment in different ways. And eventually you get a pretty good feeling for what she thinks about something. My mom is lucky that she has family members who can facilitate that process and who know her and her pre-existing wishes very, very well. But in the decision-making space in diseases like Alzheimer's or other diseases with cognitive impairment, who is the decision maker, as you're saying, is a lot less important than who all is moving through this decision. How do we engage the people who would be important to the patient to be engaged? And how do we approach this decision? It's a slower and thornier, more complex process than I think it is in other situations like I encounter at work where the patient's in a coma and they just can't participate at all.
You mentioned presenting pieces of the situation, and I'm just curious what that looks like. You know, do you say, hey, mom, now we're going to talk about this 22% risk of bleeding in the brain. We're just going to focus on risk. How are you feeling about that? Or, hey, mom, now we're going to focus on the fact that you have built a life in clinical trials and are passionate about advancing science. And what might it mean to you to be part of this experience of taking a brand new medicine and helping generate new knowledge about the medicine? Like, what does it look like to bring the different pieces in these conversations?
Yeah, you nailed it. You know, the way I framed this piece that we keep referring to was really charting a conversation that I had with my mom about this drug. And that conversation took place over 3 hours. My mom used to map my problems on a yellow ruled notepad, and I had to do the work of mapping this decision and then taking each piece and being like, what's your reaction to this piece? Just like you said, Emily, what's your reaction to the idea that, you know, a fifth of people have swelling or hemorrhage in their brain from this drug? Wait. And it helps, because some things, like, I would expect a big reaction and she's not that worried about it. And what wound up happening, and as I chart in the piece, what she wound up doing after this whole discussion happened was she just basically started talking very eloquently about her commitment to ambitious medical science. That came from her, not from me. And she was the one who ultimately drew the connection between what she's doing with this medication and how she managed her patients all those years. It just took hours to get there.
You wrote in your piece, everyone knows the big milestones of Alzheimer's, getting lost in familiar places, forgetting the names of loved ones. I fear these changes for my mom, but at least I can see them coming. What's hardest about this earlier stage of the disease is discovering again and again that she's already lost something subtler, like her ability to map the risk and benefits of a medical decision. If I could just anticipate such losses, I could prepare for them, and then maybe they wouldn't hurt so much. But it would be impossible to anticipate them all, just as it would be impossible to generate a list of the thousands of things I love about her. Losing the myriad parts of my mom, it's like stars fading in the morning. Even scanning the sky, you can't catch them right as they disappear. There just seem to be fewer and fewer until all is bright. I loved that metaphor, and a theme that comes up again and again in these conversations is this idea of complex grief or subtle losses or the long goodbye or whatever spin you want to put on it. And I think this is the part of this disease that is just so hard. Like you said, it's different from being in a coma. It's like they're there. The person is still there. And. So just to bring this to a close, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts to share with the listeners who are dealing with the grief that comes along with this disease. We did spend a minute talking about the silver linings and the presence, but on the whole, obviously, this is very sad. So just wondering if you have any thoughts to share with the group about how you move through that sadness and those subtle losses.
Oh, yeah, it's really hard. I have two young children. I wrote this piece at like 5 o'clock in the morning, a bunch of mornings in a row in the dark. And I knew I was getting somewhere when I was just like sobbing as I wrote. It's really, really hard. I mean, all I can really say is that nothing I do right now is going to make that go away. And in my work every day, I see people who have been lost or who a big part of who they were was lost very suddenly. And I remain grateful for the fact that I can savor my mom as she is now. And I've noticed that if I spend a lot of my energy noticing what's not working with her brain, I don't get to that part of enjoying and savoring her now. This has been especially hard for me as a doctor who notices pathology, who notices clinical signs and problems, to try to snap out of a mindset of noticing all that. It's not clinically useful for me to notice that. So that's the work that I've tried to do around this grief. I wish I had not spent quite so much time worrying at the beginning and sort of just like my mom did, actually trust the process, trust that she's in the hands of a good neurologist, trust that what's going to come is what's going to come and enjoy what's currently going well. I wish I had savored her more earlier on. I do feel like I'm doing a better job savoring her now. That's really hard to do. But maybe it gets a little bit easier when we know the diagnosis, when that worrying about is this Alzheimer's or not is gone. It is. And we're still losing parts of her, but there's that kind of acceptance phase that's kicked in, that's palliating in a way. It is like the definition of ambiguous grief. It's grieving something that's imprecise and ever shifting. And there isn't the resolution that comes with death. But I just keep thinking that I'm really glad she's still here. A lot of her is still here.
I think that's a really great note to end on. And just want to say thank you so much, Adeline, for joining us at REMO to talk about your essay, to talk about your experience with your mom and also your experience as a physician. It's just been really great to chat. And I urge everyone who's listening to check out the essay. It's really powerful. So thanks again.
Thanks so much, Emily, for inviting me and for your thoughtful questions.
Thanks for listening to Talking Dementia with REMO Health. If you're looking for more information, resources, and expert insights, visit remo.health and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, take care.